this past week, we had the first of what I'm sure will be many debates and speeches and presentations. You'll have the nominations, and then, you know, the country gets gripped through this whole process. And maybe for some of you, maybe you've become a bit cynical, so you're like, why vote? It doesn't matter, especially we're in California. It's already over by the time it gets here. And oftentimes it feels like it. And sometimes Angela and I, we would go to the polls like 15 minutes before it closes. And if you watch the news, it's already done, right? They've already projected who's going to win this and that. And you wonder, does it even make a difference? Well, I don't know, but I do know this. What's really interesting is that people are so interested in this process. In fact, some people get really worked up about it. And I don't know if you are following who are the potential candidates, but what I find really, really fascinating is that in a country that prides itself on expressions of autonomy, self-will, self-identity, and if someone wants to exercise authority over us, it's like, get away from me. I don't want you telling me what to do. With a country that is filled with that kind of thinking, they still want leadership. They still want someone to say, show us where to go. Show us how we're supposed to respond to things in life. Help provide guidance. Take care of us when our enemies attack us, right? I mean, is that not what we expect out of a president? And so that's why I think it's just really, really interesting that at a very practical level, most of us are like, don't tell me what to do. I want to be myself. I want to do what I want. Don't tell me who I'm supposed to be. But then all of a sudden, this presidential election kind of things gets people to come together. And then you're like, Are you Republican? Oh, okay, good. I remember back in San Diego when we started Lighthouse there. after service, a gal came up and said, is it okay to be a Democrat at Lighthouse? I'm like, what? I go, what are you talking about? It seems like everyone's Republican. we're not a political entity here. In fact, we don't promote that kind of thing. In fact, as a nonprofit, we're not supposed to. Sure, you can be a Democrat. You can be an independent. You can be, you know, Tea Party, Green Tea. I mean, whatever you want. You know, I'm sorry. No, the Green. It was Green Party. So, I suppose you could be whatever you like. But if there's one thing, don't place your hope in a human leader. Not that God can't use human people, he does, but ultimately, I think what we reveal through this whole process is this. Isaiah 53:6, all of us like sheep. We're sheep, and we're looking for a shepherd. Inherent in this whole thought process is this, I want to be led. And I want someone to take care of me. I want someone to make me feel safe, protected. I want someone to make sure that I got food on the table. I want someone to comfort me in times where I'm sad. But here's the thing. Isaiah 53:6 goes on and says, all of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. And who is this? It is the one who will restore the lost sheep. Jeremiah 56 says, my people have become lost sheep. Their shepherds have led them astray. They have made them turn aside on the mountains. They have gone along from mountain to hill and have forgotten their resting place. And so this imagery of lost sheep is very much one relevant to us. Zechariah 10:2 says, for the teraphim speak iniquity, and the diviners see lying visions and tell false dreams. They comfort in vain. Therefore, the people wander like sheep. They are afflicted because there is no shepherd. Now, for those of you who are here today, last week we looked at Psalm 23. We looked at the first half, and we're continuing today. But I wanted to give a little bit more background so you can get perspective. We are like sheep who wander, who are lost. And we live in a world filled with false shepherds who lead people astray. That's why when Jesus came onto the scene, you could see that his heart really felt for us as lost sheep. Mark 6:34 says, when Jesus went ashore, he saw a large crowd and he felt compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. Well, today we are a gathering of sheep. I'm a sheep as well. I am not the ultimate shepherd. You know, if anything, I suppose I would be like an under-shepherd. Or maybe a better picture yet would be a shepherd dog. You know, I just yap around to get you back into the fold to go follow the shepherd. Because we are like these lost sheep. We need a shepherd. And the scriptures are clear that the Lord is the great shepherd. Jesus is the good shepherd. And because when we say, the Lord is my shepherd, we can count on him doing all that a good shepherd does. His leading, his guiding, his protecting, his caring. So last week when we started with verse 1, and it says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. That first verse really sets the tone, provides the foundation for the rest of the passage in saying, the Lord, who is the Lord? The one true God, the one who has created all things. And he is the one who we can then say is my shepherd. And because he is my shepherd, I shall not want. Now just so we understand, it's not that we never have needs anymore. We still have needs. But in the midst of our needs, we are not left wanting because we have a shepherd who can meet those needs. And how does he meet those needs? Well, as we look at the rest of the passage, this is what we've been working through. First, he makes me lie down in green pastures. Second, he leads me beside quiet waters. You know, and the whole idea of provision, that he is the one who satisfies us. And he does everything to provide for us so that we are fed, that we are watered, that we can rest and be at peace. He restores my soul. He brings me back when I stray. You know, really is a picture of the one who provides for our repentance, gets us back onto the right path. That's why it says he guides me in the paths of righteousness. Why? Because his name is at stake. He doesn't do it just for us. He does it because of who he is, his integrity. If he failed to do this, he would not be a good shepherd. You know, the good shepherd is the one who goes and seeks for the lost sheep and brings them back to the right place. Now, we introduced this last week, verse 4. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. And here, the tone changes a bit, where instead of just kind of describing who God is in third person, now it's as if there's this transition, and the psalmist, who's David, now is talking straight up to God. God, you are with me. You are with me, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Because you are with me, I fear no evil. Now, last week we talked about the reality of evil being in our lives. And it can be a very disconcerting thing. But here's where we have a great promise. We have the promise of the shepherd that he will be with us as we walk through these valleys. Now, maybe in the past week, as you had a chance left from last week to think about these things, maybe you had some struggles. Maybe you had some problems. Maybe you had some difficult circumstances. Maybe you experienced a valley. Maybe a valley so dark that it fulfills this kind of picture, the shadow of death. Well, we have never been promised that there will be no valleys. We've never been told that, you know what, all your problems are going to be taken away. I think sometimes people think that Christianity is this kind of thing that will solve all your problems, make you happy, and everything will be great. And unfortunately, there are some false shepherds who preach that kind of message. Yeah, yeah, God just wants you happy. God wants you wealthy. Oh, I don't mind that one. God wants you healthy. I really don't mind that one. God wants you to be prosperous. Wow, that sounds so good. Who wouldn't like that kind of a message? But that's not the message. Not that there's anything necessarily wrong with being healthy or wealthy or prosperous. In fact, there are seasons of life where we might even enjoy those things. But that is not what we live for. That is not the goal of life. And that's why sometimes when people encounter difficult circumstances, it's almost like we're like, God, what's up with you? Why are you doing this? Why are you letting me go through this dark time? And you know what? I feel really alone. And that's one of the things about going through trials and tests. You feel alone. Why? Because you know what? No one really understands, right? No one knows. I mean, even if they see you, even if you try to share and talk, people don't understand. So that's why, you know, I don't appreciate when people go, oh, I understand what you're going through. And sometimes I'm like, no, you don't! Don't even pretend! You have no idea what's going on in my heart. But sometimes it's so hard, we feel like we're going to die. Well, that's why this particular psalm is just so comforting. It doesn't say that you will not walk through the valley of the shadow of death. In fact, sometimes to get to where God wants us to be, we have to go through such valleys. And most of us are like, really, do we have to? I mean, can't I just have like a nice level plain? In fact, it'd be even nicer if it's just downhill. I can just ride something. You know, one of my daughters was talking about mattress surfing the other day. You know, when you have stairs, you remember doing that? Get on a mattress and just go right down the stairs. That'd be kind of nice. Just lie down and just go through life. That's not reality. In fact, there is evil. There are enemies. There are people who are going to actually try to hurt you. Why? Because there's an enemy who hates God. And if you say the Lord is my shepherd, that doesn't mean now you are out of the woods. You are still going to deal with trouble. So how is it that we can have comfort and peace? Well, when it says, for you are with me, there's more involved. Who is with us? The Lord, the shepherd. But you know what? This shepherd is not just someone just sitting around talking to sheep. This shepherd has weapons. So when it says in the next phrase, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. There's something about the imagery. I was going to go bring one of my swords today, but it doesn't quite fit exactly the picture. But let me describe the two instruments that are used here. First, there is the rod. Okay? Now, when you're thinking about a rod, this rod was not just a walking stick. Kenneth Bailey, in his book, The Good Shepherd, describes a rod as a weapon about 2.5 feet long, and it has a mace-like end. Heavy pieces of iron were embedded. And so this is a weapon that is meant to kill. Now you go, well, what's a shepherd doing with that? Well, what do you think are going to be coming after sheep? Predators. Remember, because sheep are really like helpless creatures. It's just like dinner waiting to be served. Right? Lions walking by. Oh, sheep, this is easy. Other things you gotta chase, and they're gonna scratch and fight back and bite you. Sheep, it's like fast food. Okay? I mean, you just gotta go through the drive-thru. There it is. Bam. So the shepherd has to protect the sheep. Now, just to get a picture of this, turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 34. This is David. Okay, and he's with King Saul, and this is when the army of Israel is facing the army of the Philistines, and Goliath is coming out every day and issuing a challenge. hey, anyone want to go one-on-one with me? And everyone is scared because Goliath is a giant, right? In fact, I think it was this past week, they found the remains of one of the Philistine cities, and there's indications that it very much fits the biblical accounts, and that indeed there were giants. So David comes, and he's like a little teenage guy. You know, he's got zits, and he's just like very, you know, young, and, you know, not only that, he's redheaded, so, you know, he's kind of like got a lot of stuff not going for him, and he's the runt, right? He's the youngest, and then he comes because he came to bring food for his brothers, and he sees what's going on, and he's like, I'll take him. And so you can imagine, everyone's looking at him going, what are you going to do? I mean, we have trained military men here. You don't even have armor. You have like a sling. What are you going to do? Well, then this is what David says. Verse 34 of 1 Samuel 17. But David said to Saul, your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, and may the Lord be with you. Now, if you read the text there, it says David seized the lion by the beard and struck him and killed him. Now, if you read sort of carelessly, you go, he grabbed him by the beard and killed him? How do you kill someone by grabbing him by the beard? Well, what it doesn't say directly is that, well, it's close proximity, right? Why is he grabbing the beard? He's bringing him in so he can do what? Kill him with his rod. David understood that this is a weapon which was used to kill predators. Now, I don't know about you, you know, like I have these swords in my office. For those of you who are new, I like swords. And so I've been getting gifts of swords, also knives and other various blades. And I always have this sort of nagging picture in my mind. If someone were to ever attack my wife or my daughters, what would I do? I just think about that randomly. Not that anyone has, but I think about it. And to protect them, I need weapons. I have my weapons. And I would draw you into close proximity to make sure you were dealt with. You understand? That's the idea. So I would hope my wife and daughters know that I'm here to protect them. Daddy will take care of you, my daughters. Honey, don't worry, I got you. Now that's a little picture, okay? A very low life picture. But you magnify that much more. When God says, I'm with you, he is the one who truly will protect us from our enemies. This same rod was also used to count the sheep. Now, this is a very interesting picture. At nighttime, when the shepherd would bring the sheep in, bring them through the door of the sheepfold, and he would lay out the rod and count them as they would go. So what's interesting is the sheep would see this rod, this weapon that is meant to kill the predators. So on one hand, it gives a sense of protection. When the sheep see when they see the shepherd with the rod, they're like, all right, daddy's here. No one's going to get us. But not only that, at nighttime, it becomes a little different instrument where they pass under the rod and they're getting counted. Because after the shepherd does the count, if that count is short, what do you think he's going to do? Go find any lost sheep. Now, this is pictured in Leviticus 27:32. It says, for every tenth part of a herd or flock, whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. So that imagery is very clear. As a shepherd would be counting the sheep and saying, okay, every tenth sheep, you're going to be dedicated to the Lord. The same idea. This rod is looking out for you. making sure you're here, making sure you're home, making sure you're taken care of. And if you're lost, I'm going to be coming out to find you. That was the rod. Now the staff. The staff is that maybe picture that we would associate with a shepherd. It's that shepherd's crook. A little bit longer, maybe about 5 feet. Has a little crook at the end. This would be used by the shepherd to lean on, to climb with. It would also be used to guide the edges of the flock, so that if the sheep are starting to wander, this is what the shepherd used to kind of gently guide it back in. Sometimes a sheep would fall into a crevice or down a bank, and so then the shepherd would take the crook, catch him by the leg or the shoulder, and gently lift it back to the path. So it was an instrument meant to care for the sheep. So if you can imagine being a sheep, and remember sheep, they don't got much going on in there, okay? But they see the picture of the shepherd, you can imagine it something like this. There's our daddy. He makes sure I eat, makes sure I get water, makes sure I can rest. And if a lion or a bear or something comes, he's got him. And if I fall down, he's going to pick me up. And he's always with me. And that's the job of the shepherd. The shepherd is always with the sheep, 24/7. The question is this. Do you believe it? Do you really trust that the shepherd is with you? You know, that's why I think Psalm 23 is such a helpful psalm. As you recite it to yourself, do you really believe this to be true? The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. I will fear no evil because you are with me. God, you have a rod and staff that comfort me. Why? Because I know you are strong. I know you are committed to my protection. I know that you will even gently take care of me as I start to stray off the path. We were going through a series on contentment with the singles. And, you know, contentment's a tricky thing in that we often have a hard time being content because we only think about what affects me. And obviously a lot of times we're not satisfied. We're not happy. We're not content with what we've been given. And then sometimes we see what someone else goes through. And then we're like, wow, they're going through a lot. And maybe our first thought is this, I'm sure glad it's not me. I'm sure glad I'm not the one going through that. For example, I have a pastor friend in NorCal whose daughter is suffering from stage 4 neuroblastoma. And she's only like 2 years old. And it is the saddest thing. I got a chance to see them a few months ago. And she is currently going through all sorts of, you know, treatments. And I know some of you are praying for her, as you know, we've posted that. And the one thing that my friend and his wife said is that, you know, it's been such a difficult time. Well, obviously, because the doctors have given little hope along the way. Stage 4. There hasn't been a lot of response to the treatments. And I see that and go, wow, you know, I have 4 daughters that are healthy, you know, they're lively. They got a lot of energy. They got a lot of emotion. They got a lot of stuff going on. And then I complain? Like, how could I complain? Like, when here's a friend who's wondering if their daughter will even live. That picture is, I think, more worthy of the valley of the shadow of death than anything I would be going through. But here's the thing. They have the same hope that is available to me too. Why? Because the Lord is their shepherd too. And the Lord is the one who protects them and comforts them. You know, if you don't have that, what do? You know, some people might think, well, oh, you Christians, you just have like this crutch that you've kind of made up in your mind that, you know, this Jesus is going to somehow take care of you. But look what happens. He doesn't always come through. People die. People don't miraculously always recover. Some people suffer for the rest of their lives. How is that a good thing? Well, if that's all you see, you don't know the Good Shepherd. Because we have a little bit more we're going to look at. But at least when we look at this verse 4, how does this relate to that phrase in verse 1, I shall not want? Well, you know what? When I am going through the valley of the shadow of death, I don't need, because I already have the one who is with me. That's why I don't have to fear evil, even though evil might be staring me in the face. Let's move on. The next way we see that we shall not want is in verse 5. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Now, this is a really interesting thing because there's a shift. While Psalm 23 would be maybe predominantly this image of a shepherd and sheep, it moves to that of which I would say would be the great host. Okay? Because now it's talking about a host dealing with people. It's moved on from sheep, and now there's this picture of God, who is the great shepherd, being now the great host. Now, here's one of the things which is helpful when you consider the original context of these writings. Okay, so Israel's in the Middle East, and in the Middle East there are many customs. And one of the customs of the Middle East would be this. If you were wealthy, okay, and you wanted people to know you were wealthy, how would you display it? Well, here in SoCal, we know how we would display it, right? You would first of all get a nice car, right? Because you drive around LA, you know, you ever see that when some nice car drives, you know, it's going by? You're like, wow. And, you know, and I think that car, it's a nice car, but it's going to go to the same place where my car, my junky car goes, into the junkyard. You know, in fact, yesterday I was talking. I was talking to someone about food, and we're talking about, you know, some people go to these fancy restaurants, they get all this fancy food and spend all this money, and said it all turns out the same way. Right? That was not mine, that was someone else's, okay, just so you know. And I was thinking, that's so true. I mean, you can spend $100, you can spend $5. It ends up through the same process. It comes out the same. So I'm thinking, wow, you know, you want to show that you're wealthy? Well, drive a nice car, and then you got to go get designer clothes, right? You got to wear, like, the fancy clothes. So when you walk by, people go, oh. And then maybe you got to do your hair, you know? I mean, both ladies and guys, there's a lot of hair issues, right? That's why, like, when guys when guys start to lose their hair, it's almost like your manhood's being, like, taken away somehow. So that's why there's such a big industry now of hair transplants, things like that, right? Not only that, you need to get a big house, and it needs to be a nice house in a nice part of town, and you got to have nice furniture. You got to get the designer furniture. I mean, there's so much people do to display their wealth. Back then, if you want to display your wealth, you know what you would do? You invite people to your home, and you would feed them. But you wouldn't just feed them. You would give them, like, three times the amount of food that they would be able to normally eat, because that would be a display of your wealth, okay? Now you go, what's the point of that if you couldn't eat it all? Well, it wasn't just that it was about you. It was about someone who had wealth. What they would do is they would share that wealth with their community. It wasn't about displaying them. It was about being a blessing to the rest and not being like all like a tightwad about it. You know, like if you invited everyone, to, like say you invited the church over for dinner, And you're like, oh man, that's a lot of people.
What would I feed them?
I could get crackers and cheese. And I think then I would be able to feed everyone. See, that's not the mentality that they had. They would say, you know what? I'm going to be generous. I'm going to be magnanimous. And I don't care what anyone thinks. So here's the host providing a spread. Okay? Like when we would go on missions, I remember the first time we went to the Czech Republic, you know, we got to the church and they had this big spread, this table. And everything looked so colorful, and I was like, oh, and everything tasted really different. You know, it was not like what you thought it was. But the thing was, they set a spread. There was so much food. I remember the first time I went to Argentina, they did the same thing. They made empanadas. You ever had empanadas? No, you haven't had empanadas. Until you go to Tucumán, Argentina, where they make it, like, right there in front of you, like, from scratch. It is so good. It is so good. And then when we go, and they just have like dozens and dozens of empanadas. I mean, they're just bringing them out. They're making them as we're eating them. And you're eating and eating, and you want to eat more and more. Even if you can't eat anymore, because you don't want it to go to waste. You don't want to lose the opportunity. That's the idea. There's this like just magnanimous spread. Now, some people are going to look at that and go, what a waste. Why are you spending all that money and why are you going to all that effort to prepare a table to feed these people? Well, this is a picture of who our God is. Our God has shown us a costly love by throwing us a feast. And people who are hostile to us, our enemies, they don't know what to do with that. And they are correct. We don't deserve it. So why would God do such a thing? Well, it shows His grace, His mercy, His forgiveness, His restoration, His love in a way that enemies don't understand. Maybe the best picture of this would be the parable of the prodigal son. Remember the son, the younger son? He essentially tells his dad, Dad, I want my inheritance. But it doesn't look like you're going to die anytime soon. You're still too young. But I want my inheritance now. So can I get it? And the father is like, wow, he wants me dead. He doesn't even care about me. He just wants my money. But because he is a gracious father, he liquidates assets and he gives it to his son. And what does his son do? He blows it all. It's like he went to the arcade and spent $10 million on video games. You know, I mean, what would you do? I mean, I could understand like 10 bucks. I could even understand 100 bucks. But spending like $10 million on video games? I mean, everyone's going to look at that and go, you wasted your inheritance like that? And the guy did probably much worse. So then when he is now completely broke, and then he realizes, you know what, even my father's servants are pretty well taken care of. I'm going to go back and say, Father, I no longer deserve to be called your son. Can I just be one of your servants? Now, I don't know about you. If you were the father of that son, what would you do? They blew like $10 million. And it wasn't even just the money. They wanted you dead. That's how much they didn't care. Now, you know what? Because in this context, everybody knows. Everybody knows. The whole village knows. So if you imagine when this son is coming back, you want to know one of the reasons why the father runs out? Because if the father didn't run out, and if the villagers saw this prodigal son come back, they'd kill him. Because he disgraced his father. Or at the least, they'd run him out of town. So you were such a disgrace. You hated your father. You wanted him dead. And you blew your inheritance. You don't deserve to be back here. So the father runs, gives him a robe, a ring, and says, I'm going to throw you a feast. So they get the fatted calf, and he invites the whole village. Now, here's the perspective that I think is helpful to understand. When they're throwing this party, when there's this party there, What do you think the people are thinking of that son? Okay, let's just pretend Terrence is the son. Okay? So you're looking at him and you're like, he's wearing his dad's fancy robe. He's wearing the big ring, you know, the bling bling, you know. And so he doesn't deserve it. What is he doing here? What is his father thinking? You don't think that that son knew that these eyes were boring in on him? He knows he doesn't deserve it. But you know what? The party wasn't for him. The party was to show the magnanimous love of the Father. And he doesn't care what the enemies think. It's irrelevant. Why? Because he is manifesting his forgiveness, his restoration, his love. So when in Psalm 23 it says, you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies, it's almost like this. Everyone else is looking and go, why is God throwing you a party? You don't deserve it. You're worthless. You're a waste. You even mock God's name. I mean, you don't even, you're not even obedient all the time. You're lame. You're a disgrace. And God says, I don't care what they think. You're my sheep. And I'm going to take care of you. Another example would be the story of Zacchaeus. Remember Zacchaeus? Zacchaeus was a wee little man. A wee little man was he, right? So, little guy. Okay, probably had, you know, issues with that. He hears Jesus coming to town one day. He can't see. He's short. So he has to climb a tree. So he climbs a tree. Jesus calls him out. Hey, Zacchaeus. Could you imagine? I mean, he's so excited. He wants to see Jesus. But he's what? He's a tax collector. Everybody hates the tax collector. So when Jesus goes, Zacchaeus, I mean, he actually names him. He says, you know what? Come down. Because I'm going to your house today, right? And not only does he go to his house, what does he do? He sits at the table. And he eats with Zacchaeus. And then the religious leaders, what are they thinking? Does Jesus know what he's doing? He is digging his own grave. He is committing social suicide. You don't eat with tax collectors, right? But he's sharing a table. Why? Because it's a picture of his grace and his mercy. And he is welcoming Zacchaeus, even in the presence of his enemies. Now, one other thought to mention, this is a very interesting cultural perspective. When it says in verse 5, you, the Lord, my shepherd, now you are my host, you are the one that not only is providing the table, you are preparing the table. Now, have any of you ever prepared food for people? I've tried to prepare food, okay? And it's a lot of hard work. Like when my wife is, you know, out of town or something, it makes me appreciate her all the more because, wow, preparing a meal is a pain. I mean, all I make is egg rice, okay? But even making the rice, I don't even make the rice. I just wash the rice, rinse the rice, put it in the rice cooker, and then cut up the Spam. You know, trying to cut it evenly and fry the Spam, fry the eggs. So much work. That's why in a lot of Asian cultures, you know, or at least maybe Korean, you know, you don't see a lot of men doing preparing. They just do the eating. Okay? They don't even set the table. Just come and eat. In the Middle Eastern culture, men never prepared the table. Okay? That's what the women did. Just describing what it's like. Okay? They might provide for what will be set on the table. They'll go get the lamb or the calf or they'll, but the women would prepare. Now, this is what is very, very interesting to consider. Culturally speaking, In a world that only expects women to prepare a table, who's preparing the table here? Who? Who? God! God! Now, some guy, some misguided misogynist who's, you know, lame brain, might go, God, what are you doing? You don't do this. This is beyond you. God, we should serve you. You missed the whole point then. Here's God humbling himself to serve us. And you know what? He doesn't care what anyone else thinks. We don't deserve this. You know, he sets the table, he prepares the food. And even as enemies are watching on, he has absolutely no concern what they think about him or us. He loves us. That's why I shall not want. We have a God who cares that much. When it says there in verse 5, you have anointed my head with oil. Now, we don't do this kind of thing these days. But back in those days, if you were a guest at a home, they would anoint your head with oil. It was a sign of hospitality. And it was a sign of a host that said, you know what, I welcome you. And I want you to smell good. I want you to feel good. Get a little oil, you know, a little massage, feel good. Come sit at the table. You are my welcomed guest. In fact, I was reading one story about they had these cones of oil that they would put on your head, and then your body heat would have it melt, and it would just kind of constantly be rolling down you. I'm thinking, that's weird. I mean, like, but they actually have pictures of this kind of thing, where that was a sign of being welcomed into someone's home. You're anointed with oil. But the picture is this. You're welcomed. Now, how do we know this is a big deal? Well, turn over to Luke chapter 7. Starting from verse 36, and this is the story where we see Jesus hanging out with some of the Pharisees. Look at verse 36, Luke 7. It says, now one of the Pharisees was requesting him to dine with him. So a Pharisee asked Jesus, hey, let's go grab lunch. And so he entered the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. So you would think, oh, wow, this Pharisee, maybe he's open. Maybe he wants to get to know Jesus. Not really. I mean, it's more like he's sizing up Jesus. It's more like he's trying to find a way to nail him. Verse 37, there was a woman in the city who was a sinner. Okay. That's code for bad lady. And when she learned that he was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster vial of perfume. Standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and kept wiping them with the hair of her head, and kissing his feet and anointing them with the perfume. Now, this has got to be an interesting scene. Can you imagine? You invited someone over for lunch to your house, and a woman of disrepute comes in. But she breaks open this thing of perfume, and she's crying and wiping Jesus' feet with her hair and tears, and then anoints his feet with this perfume. So, man, his feet got to smell good, but what's going on here? Well, here's what the Pharisee's saying to himself. If this man were a prophet, he would know who and what sort of person this woman is who is touching him, that she is a sinner. So you see this heart of disdain. It's like, does Jesus even know what kind of woman this is, this trashy woman? And then Jesus says this, Simon, I have something to say to you. That should warn you something is coming. Okay? When Jesus says, I have something to say to you, okay, this can't be good. He replied, say it, teacher. I mean, you can almost like feel the, yeah, what do you got to say? A moneylender had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they were unable to repay, he graciously forgave them both. So which of them will love him more? That seems pretty simple. If you got told that story, what would you reply with? I mean, is that hard? No, the one who was forgiven more. But then look, listen to how Simon responds. Simon answered and said, I suppose the one whom he forgave more. Even though he used that word suppose, I don't know, to me that almost reeks of like, I suppose the one whom he forgave more. I mean, what? You trying to quiz me here, Jesus? Is this so hard? And then Jesus says, you have judged correctly. You're right. Turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, do you see this woman? Obviously he sees the woman. I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but she, since the time I came in, has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she anointed my feet with perfume. So what is Jesus saying? You, Simon, are a terrible host. You did nothing to show that you welcomed me. You didn't do anything. You didn't give me water to even wash. You didn't give me a welcome kiss. You didn't give me oil. You did nothing to show that I was welcomed. You've revealed your heart. Why? Because you think you're so great. You think you're so good. Verse 47, for this reason I say to you, her sins, which are many, have been forgiven, for she loved much, but he who is forgiven little loves little. Wow. You see, this woman, though she was this sinner, this woman of disrepute, she got it. She welcomed Jesus into her home, her life, her heart, because she knew she was a great sinner. But Simon, no. So that's why in verse 48, when it says, then he said to her, your sins have been forgiven. Those who were reclining at the table with him began to say to themselves, who is this man who even forgives sins? See, they don't get it. They don't understand. Who does this guy think he is that he says he could forgive sins? And not only that, he's treating this like bad woman as more valuable than this religious leader. Verse 50, and he said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Going back to Psalm 23, when it says, you have anointed my head with oil, what's God saying here? I've welcomed you, and you are my special guest. And he is going above and beyond. Minimum. Prepare a feast for you. Anointing your head with oil, and then the last phrase in verse 5, my cup overflows. My cup overflows. The picture here is, you know, maybe you've been to like a nice restaurant where they have like these waiters just hovering, and then you take like a sip of your water, and then they come and they pour it back. Yeah. They pour. I remember one time Angela and I went to this very, very fancy restaurant in San Diego for our anniversary. And it was very limited seating. It was like, there were only like 12 tables. And it was on top of some hotel and overlooking the bay. It was the most expensive meal I think we've ever had. And they would bring everything out on a dish, like covered, you know, those little round things. And then they would open it every time and go, voila. And inside was like, you know, like little thing here. Voila. But then I remember, like, because I drink a lot of water, you know, when I'm at a restaurant. So I'm drinking, and it's like they kept coming with these bottles, pouring water. They're just waiting there. And it was almost like, you know, it was like a game. It was like, you know, see if I catch them without. Why? Because they wanted to keep your cup filled. As opposed to some other restaurants where I drink my water cup and I'm like, it's empty! My cup is not only not overflowing, it's empty. And then that's why you get a bad Yelp review. Because you don't even fill my water cup, right? You go to someone's home and if they did that, they forgot about you, you know, you say they're giving you some spicy meal. You know, like, this is hot. My cup doesn't have anything in it. Well, a good host keeps the cup overflowing. That's the picture here. So you pool this all together. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. The Lord is also the great host. And when I am under his care, wow. He is not minimal in his provision. He spreads a feast. He anoints my head with oil. My cup overflows. All the while, enemies are watching and going, "You don't deserve this kind of treatment. Who are you?" This is what the great shepherd does for his sheep. That's why from verse 2 to verse 5, it really fleshes out why we could say, "I shall not want." Well, here's the last verse, and this is the closing promise. Verse 6, "Surely goodness and loving kindness will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." I want to look at two things here. First, when it says, "Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life," what does that really mean? I think some people think it means everything in my life is supposed to be good. So when bad things happen, we go, wait a second. It says here in verse 6, goodness is supposed to follow me. Where is the goodness, God? I just see a lot of badness. This is like bad stuff happening. I don't get it. Well, what do we expect when it comes to experiencing goodness? Now, the Hebrew word for good here is this idea of pleasant, useful, efficient, beautiful, kind, right, that which is morally good. Now, reality is that there are a lot of things that happen in life that are not that. Like driving back from San Diego yesterday, I saw two car accidents, and I can't think of any car accident that's good. Car accidents are bad. It causes traffic. Traffic's already bad, now it makes it even worse. How do you call something good? Well, I think we need to move beyond that which we see as a manifestation of good. And do you go to the source? Turn to Romans 8:28. And I'm sure this is a familiar verse for many of you. But then let's read it. It says, "And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose." Now, as you're walking on the course of your life and you're like, "Okay, God, you've made this promise for goodness and loving kindness to follow me." Some of these things are happening. "God, did you like take a nap here? I mean, are you like not looking out after me? I mean, I thought you're supposed to be with me, right? You're supposed to be the shepherd. I mean, what's going on?" Well, he is there with us. Remember, there's still the valley of the shadow of death. There are enemies. This is not the promise of a life 100% just to make you happy. Like driving on the way here, I was thinking about the sermon, and you know that song, "Happy, Happy." You know, I don't even know all the words. I just know "Happy, Happy," whatever. Right? I was making up my own tune, and I was thinking, you know what? The world essentially saying something like this to God: "Make me happy, happy, happy. If you don't, I hate you. Make me happy, happy. I don't care about anyone else. Make me happy, happy, happy." That's what I was singing to myself. Because that's essentially what people are thinking. I want to be happy. Whether you're happy or not, I mean, if you're happy too, that's good. But it really doesn't matter whether you're happy or not. What matters is that I'm happy. Because that means my life is good. That means the things are working out the way I want. Sorry if your life's not working out the way you'd like. Not my problem. Well, it's one thing to point it out against others. It's another thing to question God and his goodness. God says he will work all things out for good.
So it's God who is good. It is God's goodness who follows you. It is God who provides the security and the promise that there will be good. Even if what immediately looks like bad is right in front of me, and it's not to say that bad is good. Bad is bad. When people do evil things, it's evil. It is completely wrong. But God still works good. It's His goodness that will follow you. Secondly, it is His loving kindness. And this is a great word to learn in Hebrew. It's chesed. Okay, try it. Chesed. A little guttural. Like you're going to spit. Chesed. Okay. What is that chesed? It's God's loving kindness, His faithfulness, His covenantal love. A love that doesn't fail. It is His kindness. It is a love that says God is making a covenant that He will not break. And it is not that we deserve it. It is that we are graciously given to it, given it. This is the God who follows us. You know, as a parent, you get to experience a little bit of this, especially when your kids are little. Right? When your kids learn to start walking and then they start running, what do? They start running everywhere. Right? I mean, you just see the kids here. They just come running and one of them bit it right there. Okay? And as a parent, you're like following them. Why? Because you're constantly worried. They're going to fall. They're going to scrape their knee. They're going to bump their head. So you're following. Why? Even though you're tired. And they do this like a million times. After a while, you might just go, forget it. I'm tired. You're going to fall. You're going to fall. Doesn't matter. Now, that's sad if you're that parent. A parent, though, that they are dead tired. And they're doing this now for the millionth time. There is a covenantal love with your child. That's why sometimes when, as a parent, you're following your kid, and they're like, go away! I don't want you close by! It's like you can't help it as a parent, because you love them. And sometimes they don't want it. But there is this covenantal love that is faithful. Kenneth Bailey again writes, in our text, David seems to be affirming that he lives his life with all of its fears and dangers with the awareness that following behind him is a God who both supports him out of covenant faithfulness and at the same time extends grace, loving kindness to him that he does not deserve. So, surely goodness and loving kindness will follow me for how long? All the days of my life. So how many days? All. We're not talking percentages here. Not most of the time, not some of the time, not barely any of the time, all. So you're like, wow, you know what? Sometimes I have some pretty bad days. And I don't feel like goodness and loving kindness are following. No, they're always following. Because God is with you. It's His goodness. It's His loving kindness. They're not just some sort of ethereal concepts out there that's this like goodness is sort of this blob of goodness and loving kindness is following you. You know, in fact, some people interpret this passage to be they're like guardian angels. They're following you. No, these are not guardian angels. It's talking about God. It's His goodness. It's His loving kindness. Despite what you feel, despite what you see, despite what you think, it says, surely, you can bank on this. You can have confidence in this. You can be assured of this. God's goodness and loving kindness are going to follow you all the days of your life. And then the last phrase, this is the promise. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now, some might go, well, is that talking about heaven? Sounds like it. Well, that's for sure. I mean, there's a future sense, but is it just heaven? How do I understand this idea of the house of the Lord?
I mean, it does say forever, but is it just reduced to the future? Or could it be that it's now too? But am I in the house of the Lord now? Well, turn over to Psalm 27, starting from verse 4. Psalm 27, verse 4, it says, "One thing I have asked from the Lord, that I shall seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life." All the days of my life. "To behold the beauty of the Lord and to meditate in his temple. For in the day of trouble he will conceal me in his tabernacle. In the secret place of his tent he will hide me. He will lift me up on a rock. And now my head will be lifted up above my enemies around me. And I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing, yes, I will sing praises to the Lord." So could it be that the house of the Lord is not just heaven? And could it be that maybe actually all the days of my life, there is a sense where I acknowledge the house of the Lord wherever I am, because this all is the Lord's in the first place, and that because of my relationship with him, I can have the assurance and confidence that my home is actually always with him. That's why in the day of trouble, he conceals me. That's why in the secret place, he will hide me. And that's why he will lift me up on a rock. I mean, are we talking about a literal rock here? Are we talking about a literal tent here? Are we talking about a literal tabernacle? No, we don't have a tabernacle. Have you seen a tabernacle lately around here? I saw one in Israel. They did a like recreation of the tabernacle. It's just like a big tent. No. It's talking about something in principle. "I will offer in this tent sacrifices with shouts of joy." When it says, "I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever," it is to essentially say, I am in a constant place where I know I am in worship of God. I sing praises to him. I find my protection and comfort in him. It is to see God as the one who is not only the great shepherd, the great host. He is my life. My whole life is encompassed in him. That's why the psalmist there in verse 4 says, "One thing I have asked from the Lord that I shall seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life and to behold the beauty of the Lord." He's not talking about going to church every day. He's not talking about living at the church. What he's talking about is looking at all of life in this kind of mindset. You see, to live with Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior, it's a 24/7 thing. It would be to see the imagery of a shepherd who has laid down his life for the sheep. The shepherd, 24/7, cares for me. That's why from Psalm 23, you get this idea that from morning to night, and even when there's danger, and even when there's a valley, and even as it's time to sleep, the shepherd is the one who is always there, makes sure no one is lost, that all are provided for, all are protected, all are cared for, all are made to feel at peace and comforted. Now, if you live with that kind of mindset, and then you understand that God is the one who also prepares the table, anoints my head. I mean, he does everything. He provides for everything. The appropriate response would be to see all of life as worship. Psalm 79:13 says, "So we, your people, and the sheep of your pasture, will give thanks to you forever. To all generations we will tell of your praise." So if this is the great shepherd, can we trust him? Can we follow him? Can we have confidence and comfort in him? Yes. Takeaway point for today: trust and obey the great shepherd alone. He will provide, protect, and secure you for all your days.
That includes today, the present. You know what I like about Psalm 23 in the New American Standard? It talks about all these things pretty much in like a present tense sense. I'm living in the reality of these things being true right now. He makes me lie down now. He leads me now. He restores me now. He guides me now. You are with me now. You know, you prepare a table. It's not that just, God, you did some of these things in the past. God, you do these things all the time. And that's why for all of my days and forever, I see my whole life as if I'm living in the house of the Lord. And I shall not want.